This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. Today, we revisit a discussion between the comedy writer Armando Iannucci, Labour MP Jess Phillips, and the satirist Jan Ravens. The event asked the question, what is the point of satire in an age of political absurdity? Chairing the event from early 2020 was Samira Ahmed. Here's Samira with more.
Good evening, everyone. And I think we've picked a very good night for satire in an age of absurdity. In the last few days alone, we've seen President Trump's attack on the judiciary escalate, the suffering of people seeing their homes and livelihoods destroyed in all-too-familiar-looking flooding, a female TV presenter who was given hostile coverage in the tabloid press take her own life, and then we find said papers and the nation at large express huge sorrow, sympathy and surprise, and the mental health issues around that. And a man with racist, eugenicist and deeply misogynistic views hired and forced to quit. And crucially, number 10 saying nothing to criticise or distance themselves from his view. So an interesting time to be discussing whether we need satire. So I wanted to ask each of you, maybe Armando first, what's your favourite piece of satire? Tell us a bit about
it. My favourite piece? Well, what can be funnier than Adolf Hitler? I still think Charlie Chaplin's film The Great Dictator is one of my favourite things. I mean, not people know it, but I looked at it again before we were doing The Death of Stalin. This is a film that came out in 1941, so right in the heart of the Second World War, and it was a satire about Hitler. And it was very, very funny, but at the same time, he didn't shy away from not just setting up his oratory, but he didn't shy away from discussing the real issues, the Jewish ghettos and what was going on in the Second World War at the time in Germany. And I just see that as, for me, it was quite inspiring, really.
And quite controversial at the time, I think.
Controversial at the time, but now you just think it's just, and I'd urge you to dig it out and have a look at it, because it is remarkably funny and yet moving at the same time.
Thank you. Jess?
Well, if Armando wasn't here, I would say that The Thick of It is, for me, the greatest satire that has ever been written. And when I can't...
Pretend I'm dead.
Just, yeah. I'll make this speech when you're dead, in a room like this.
From up there.
Yeah. Because... So I would say The Thick of It. When I can't sleep at night, which is quite common because I have a quite stressful life, I am soothed by the tone of Malcolm Tucker. So I know obviously quite a lot of the people who were, you know, sort of who were around in that era in politics and it is, you know, quite accurate. But because I felt like I couldn't be just a total brown noser, I had a real think about it. And I have to say, I think that for somebody of my generation, when I was 16, Brass Eye came out, and specifically the episode that was Cake, It's a Made Up Drug, where they got people who I now sit in the House of Commons with to hold an enormous yellow tablet and say that their necks were going to be engulfed. Now, obviously, don't do drugs, kids, but as somebody who was 16 at the time and quite sort of heavily involved in going out and rave culture, that I really, really felt like an insider. knowing what the gag was all the way through to these people who just didn't get it. And I think that that is really clever when you're reaching out to a specific audience and they're in on the joke. So really good satire isn't just about sending people up, it is about people feeling like they're in on it as well. And I really felt as a 16-year-old watching it with like my parents that I really felt like losers.
I should say, Peter Capaldi told me that people come up to him on the street and say, would you swear abusively at me?
Yes.
And wanting to record stuff for their partners.
Yeah. They say, are we allowed to swear? They say, can you tell me to fuck off? And he just goes, fuck off! And they go, nice.
Oh, Jan, what about for you?
Well, there's almost, you know, an embarrassment of riches, isn't there? There's too many to... But the one that I really sort of stands out in my mind, and I don't even know if I've actually seen it. I don't know if it's available to see, but I've read about it. And it's when Peter Cook in Beyond the Fringe impersonated Macmillan. And he did this sketch as Macmillan,
and he did this, you know, he had this impression of Macmillan that was very sort of much in that sort of area. And one night, Macmillan came to see the show. He came to see Beyond the Fringe.
And everybody was very nervous about this because this was like, you know, around 1960. There hadn't really been impressions of politicians. There'd been a very sort of a culture of deference. Everybody had been very polite about politicians. And this was one of the first occasions where a politician had been portrayed, and so everybody was very, very nervous. But Peter Cook, whose kind of attitude to satire was really to sort of make mischief as opposed to kind of bring down the government or anything, he just thought this was great, you know, tip top. You know, the whole idea of being naughty was you know, really sort of up his street. So he's actually added this bit onto the Macmillan monologue, and it sort of went on much longer. And he added this bit on at the end where he said, you know, when I've nothing better to do, I like to go to my local theatre and watch a bunch of sappy, urgent, vibrant young satirists with a stupid great grin spread all over my silly old face. And, like, everybody backstage and everybody in the audience was kind of going, oh, my God, you know, this is really embarrassing. But Peter Cook just loved it because, you know, this was like proper anarchy, and And I just think it was a sort of, like, a seminal moment because it sort of symbolises this whole thing of like... You know, the start of the sort of 60s satire boom and politicians having the piss taken out of them as opposed to being kind of, you know, revered, which was kind of an important moment.
Well, in a sense, you've given us one possible definition of satire, and you've also given us a kind of significant date. So the next thing I wanted to talk to you about is how you define satire, and I'll take Amanda first. But if we look at the idea of the satire boom of the early 60s, which is often claimed as, you know, opening a new era, and then we might look forward to something like the impact of Spitting Image in the 80s. I wonder how it looks to you, as Amanda, as someone who certainly grew up in the 70s and 80s and can remember.
It's one of those weird words, satire, because it can mean so many different things, and it doesn't necessarily have to be funny, actually. But also, Britain's had this tradition going right back to Jonathan Swift and Addison and Steele in the 17th and 18th century. The cartoons about royalty that were really really cruel and vicious. And that's how I grew up thinking what satire was. There was a sort of literary tradition to it. And you know, I was a great fan. I've done David Copperfield. I was a great fan of Charles Dickens. And he's a satirist, really. You know, he's I think what he does... My definition of satire is really something that looks at how the country or how society operates. A big factor of that is politically and how the country is run. But I think it also involves, you know, how the every person is swept up by it, how it affects them. So I've never seen it as just being political.
And in terms of how it manifests itself in art forms, you gave the example of kind of historic cartoons.
Yeah.
How would you define satire in the forms it takes?
Well, of course, you know, you can be a well, it just depends what the forms are that are available. You know, you can tweet satire now. Not many people do. Some unintentionally. But, you know, it's this thing. So it's this strange word that is multimedia and multifaceted, really, which is just as well because we've got all evening to talk about it. So we can But that's how I've seen it, as something that is not afraid to take a big canvas, to go on a big stage and look at the whole scope of society.
Jan, what's your definition? Does it have to be funny?
Well, it doesn't have to, you know, in the broad definition, it doesn't have to be funny. But I think it's better if it is. And I think it has more impact if it is. Mm. I mean, I remember on Spitting Image, there were some moments that were actually like that every breath you take thing that was actually really quite moving. And we've actually even done songs on Dead Ringers that have been, that have been sort of, I remember doing, you know, Paloma Faith going, "Only Leave Can Hurt Like This." And it was, you know, there was quite moving elements of satire. But I think, you know, if you make people laugh, you've engaged them. And maybe you can make them laugh and then make them think, or maybe you can make them laugh and make them think at the same time. But if you're trying to sort of, I mean, you know, people sort of say, you know, with satire you should be pricking pomposity and exposing hypocrisy, and those, you know, those are part of it, I think. But I think also it's you know, like Peter Cook sort of did, it's to make mischief, it's to be, you know, it is to be the sort of the court jester, but not in a kind of ringing bells and being silly sort of way or wearing a daft hat. It's, you know, it's to give people a different view of things, really, I think. It's a different perspective, and maybe to sort of say, you know that thing that they're saying, well, what if you look at it like this? It's isn't that absurd? And that, to me, is sort of what satire does.
But it's disruptive, I think.
Yeah.
Can I ask, before I bring in Jess, as well, are there limits to what it can do? I was watching Spitting Image at a pantomime episode back in, I guess it would have been the very late 80s, and they shot at Hackney Empire. And the whole opening skit was about Diana throwing herself down the stairs. And it was around the time the Andrew Morton book had come out, but the divorce hadn't happened. And it really shocked me. And I couldn't imagine something like that being done now. And I wondered whether you'd have you on... whether there's a line on what's taste-wise, or should there be a line acceptable?
I think that there is a line, but I think maybe the line has got too far in one direction. People have become too sensitive because, you know, I think part of the point of satire is to cause offence, because somebody's bound to be offended by it, you know, namely the person that you're satirising and, you know, their supporters. I mean, I've done stuff about Diane Abbott, And actually they're the things that cause most sort of trouble, because people take the view that I'm being racist. And I take the view that I'm, you know, taking the piss out of Diane Abbott because she doesn't prepare properly for interviews. And I sort of think, you know, why can't you, you know, get your figures right and speak, on my behalf. And I'm a, you know, member of the Labour Party, put my hand up. And I kind of think, well, you know, that you're doing people a disservice by not being prepared for that. So I'm going to take you down for that, Mrs. Not, you know, and I think that's legitimate. I mean, obviously it's not legitimate to comment on her, you know, on the colour or the fact she's a woman, you know, that's not what I'm getting at.
And Jess, what's your definition of satire and how do you view it?
Well, I think if it's not funny, it is just cruel, and it is just often, personally, I think, I can't think of a good example of a good satire that isn't funny.
Well, I mean, there were some things on Spitting Image, and if you look back...
I mean, my view of Spitting Image as a kid who grew up in the 1980s is that is what I thought politics was.
Yes.
It's funny that is what I ended up doing. And I remember when I was first elected, I was in the first ever Parliamentary Labour Party meeting in a room not dissimilar to this. And, like, Neil Kinnock was sat next to me, and I was just taking photos of him for my dad, because it was like being in a live episode of Spitting Image. I don't think that the being cruel about people or sending people up, if it's not funny, I don't like it, because I like to be entertained, and people can say whatever they like about me, actually, as long as it's got a good gag attached to it, I will laugh, is essentially the truth. Like, you know, I don't know whether it's because I'm from Birmingham or not, but the way I show love to people is to mercilessly take the piss out of them. And my dad always says you can tell who I like because I'm awful to them. So I think that good satire most of the time, people like me shouldn't take offence to it. I don't watch the sort of idiotic characters on the thick of it and think, oh, well, you know, this is what has led to people thinking that, you know, I deserve to die or that I'm useless and that I'm living on some sort of gravy train. Mm. I look at them and I think, oh, I know that chap. There is a Ben Swain in every room in Westminster.
Oh, yeah. The very first episode of The Thick of It has them in the back of a car on the way to make an announcement, a big spending commitment. And then Malcolm rings up and says, the Prime Minister's pulling it. You've got no money. Well, I've summoned the nation's press. We'll just come up with something. And we were filming it, and we shot the scene, and we still had 10 minutes to go until we got to the next location. So I said, well, why don't you improvise just trying to come up with a policy in the back of a car? And so the actors just improvised. Now, within 5 years, three of those policies had become law. Glenn, everyone should have their own plastic bag so that we don't have to keep paying for plastic bags.
That's a great policy.
Hugh Abbott, pet asbos, which came in quite soon afterwards. And Chris...
Pet asbos.
Chris Addison came in with a national spare room database, which became the bedroom tax. So, part of the reason for bringing Thick of It to an end was when it became adopted by Parliament and Cameron started calling. He said, oh, this was Corbyn.
Something was just like him.
Just like an episode of The Thick of It. And then Ed Miliband called George Osborne's budget the Omni Shambles budget. And when it starts being... And that's what happens. Politicians do appropriate what starts off. It's like spitting image. What starts off as being actually uncomfortable, when it becomes successful, politicians kind of like the idea that there is something out there that is... mirroring their world. And you got the example of politicians then wanting to buy their spitting image puppet and that sort of thing.
Yes, so you don't feel you could write another show like that now?
I think it would have to be very, very different. And also, it's...
it'd be brilliant now.
Me too.
Dominic Cummings, it's a character waiting to happen, isn't it?
I just worry it would just be very, very depressing because... Because I think of it was an exaggeration of what was going on. But I feel now...
There's nowhere to go.
I feel now reality is an exaggeration, but I don't know of what.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? I think we're stuck in an exaggeration of something.
Looking at America as well, I mean, you've worked shows there as well. We're watching it at a distance, but there does seem to be a level of horror now to the scale of what's unfolding. How do you view the role of satire in America?
Well, that's very different. I mean, when we started, we did Veep, and I just go back to what I was saying, actually. We got shown around the West Wing by Obama's chief aide, a guy called Reggie Love, who walks around with a big sticker saying Love on his lapel. But he would show us around the West Wing, but he would reference characters from the TV show The West Wing. So he'd say, this is the Roosevelt Room. This is where CJ and George... But you're him. Can you say this is where Barack Obama, the president, would meet Angela Merkel? No, it's just this kind of strange, kind of the other side of the fence is much more interesting. Today, though, I don't know, because... You know, satire or political comedy or political humour, it kind of relies on there being an agreed set of rules by which most people abide. And we call out those who stray from the rules. But if there are no rules, you know, if Donald Trump is literally saying, I could shoot a guy in the face in Fifth Avenue and I'd still get elected...
But we still need to call that out, don't we?
Yeah.
It is very difficult with characters like Trump and Boris Johnson.
Can you talk a bit about that? Because, you know, the way that you do him on Dead Ringers, where he's got kind of split personality, I think it's quite an interesting choice, rather than the Alec Baldwin kind of straight...
Yeah. What, Trump?
...life thing, yeah.
Well, Trump hasn't got so much the split personality. It's Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson.
Yeah,
Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that I confused the two?
I know, yeah. That's weird, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, with Boris Johnson.
Sorry, because Boris Johnson is just contrasting the Prime Minister with the way that Trump is portrayed as a sort of single character.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Trump, I think, is like, he's sort of just on a single kind of line, isn't he? But yeah, on Dead Ringers, we do a thing where we have Boris kind of trying to be sort of articulate and sensible, and then, you know, no, and then there's a ha-ha, and bad Boris comes in and starts going, you know, knickers and totty, and ha-ha-ha-ha, you know, and takes over. It's like the man with two brains kind of thing. We did a sort of film-type parody. But I think America's interesting because there's so much more satire in America.
Yes.
I mean, there's all that late-night stuff, the Colbert, and...
But they have to be... they'll become more like journalists in that they've got a huge team of researchers and they're saying, okay, let's not do jokes about Trump, let's just show you what Trump said and then what he did and then what he said and then what someone else said about him and that in itself, even though it's a succession of facts,
it's very John Oliver approach,
is funny.
Yeah,
that's where they're getting, so they have to be a bit more kind of investigative, I think.
But I think it's interesting that we don't, I mean, television companies don't seem to want to do that, as far as I can tell. They seem very afraid of it because, you know, there is the potential to offend and the potential, you know, I mean, the BBC, I think, is quite sort of, you know, on tippy toes because they're scared of offending anybody because they, you know, because the license fee and everything. And then, you know, commercial television because of the advertisers. Mm. And so I think television companies are quite afraid of satire, but they seem to, I suppose it's because they're sort of individual companies, is it, in America, that they're less afraid of that?
I think it's just a bigger country and has a bigger, you know, so something here that would be cult niche viewing still gets enough viewers to justify it in terms of the advertising they get. So they can, in a strange way, take bigger risks, I think.
It's harrowing to hear you say that people can't be sent up because they're worried about being controlled by the government. It's terrifying that the idea that you can't, you know, make a wanker sign at Boris Johnson because it'll stop the BBC license fee. You know,
I don't think it's literally what's happening.
I'm just terrified. I'm just terrified by that fact.
I mean, the one thing I'll observe, there was a reunion for the 50th anniversary of That Was the Week That Was. And people talked about how at the time, I mean, there was pressure applied in different ways, but on the whole, executives and producers trusted and backed up their comedy writers and performers. And that has changed, hasn't it?
I think, well, when we were doing Dead Ringers on the telly, we were sort of more exposed in a way. You're kind of, you know, you are a bit more sort of cozy and hidden away, or certainly you were on the radio. But on telly, you know, you were more exposed. And we had an executive producer who was a very bright man, who was very anarchic, a guy called John Plowman, who exec produces all sorts of programs like Ab Fab and Inside Number 9. And he exec produced Dead Ringers. And he would just go and say, well, of course you can say that. You know, don't be daft. It's like, you know, that's the whole point. And he wasn't a Jobsworth, you know, he wasn't just there. He really fought your corner. And I think that there are now fewer people like that in, you know,
I think there is also this thing of impartiality, you know, in public service broadcasting, which is our main... Don't roll your eyes like
I'm sorry.
Don't roll your eyes at the messenger.
You know? Impartiality has gone so far that when you go on to talk about, like, you know, a nasty rape case, they have to find somebody to go up against you. So essentially I'm like, oh, great, you're going to find someone who's pro-rape. Knock yourselves out.
Yeah.
I'll take on the pro-rape person on the radio.
False equivalence,
I think. It's the false equivalence thing. Yeah. And that means you get... I mean, what you can get in America... whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but you do get voices. You do get programs that have their own voice and have their own opinion. You know, Real Time with Bill Maher is very much a kind of pro-Democrat program. However, you will get Rush Limbaugh. You know, it's not something we're used to hear. The most disruptive kind of controversial we've got is Piers Morgan in the morning. That's about it. You're rolling your eyes now. So we don't have
that. Yeah, it's a pained moment for me.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Can I ask you about development of characters, Jan? Mm-hmm. Because you did come on Front Row to talk about Theresa May when she'd just become Prime Minister, and you were obviously feeling your way around how to do her, and it was amazing how kind of confident and how she sort of became a character in a different dimension. Well, I mean, and talk me a bit through how you do people like that.
Well, with Theresa May, when she was Home Secretary, I couldn't work out how to do it because she never appeared when she was Home Secretary. And then when she sort of came out on the steps of Downing Street and made that speech about, you know, if you're born poor, you will die up to 4 years earlier than other people and all that. And I suddenly noticed this, that she was sort of held in tension the whole time. And I mean, the terrible thing about Theresa May was that she just got tenser and tenser as time went on until her shoulders were kind of completely up by her ears. And, you know, she had that, you know, that tense walk where she walks like she's carrying a drip trolley, you know. It's sort of And I just, you know, as time went on, I mean, I was like, you know, she sort of, you know, it was a great thing for me to do, and it was a great character, and you know, because things didn't work out so well, that was kind of, you know, good as well in terms of satire. But actually it became rather disturbing to watch her. And by the end, you know, we were doing, I remember doing this sketch where we were sort of going, she was going around saying, what I'm hearing. Well, I've been to Birmingham, and what I'm hearing is, and, you know, we had her sort of going to, well, here I am at the Arctic Circle, and what I'm hearing from the penguins is, and it was just sort of pathetic. And so I actually, people sort of said, oh, you must be terribly upset to have lost, you know, your Theresa May character. And I was going, no, let her go and have a rest, have a cup of tea.
Of course, there was that moment when she came on to Dancing Queen at the Tory Party conference, which seemed to fit exactly. Well, it's really interesting, the audience reaction, what I'm hearing.
I actually found it quite moving when she did that. I did, honestly, because I kind of thought, yeah, fuck it, Theresa, you know, give it to them, you know. And she sort of, it was like she was taking the piss out of herself. And there's something about her face But never, you know, you sort of can't do comedy when you look that tense.
Not so much the dancing, but if you had to satirise the year before's conference speech where she lost her voice, somebody came on and the thing fell down. I had to go into the hall, and it was like, you know, when they have the announcer on there, I had to get somebody in my living room to tell me what was happening because I could not bear to watch it. And I disliked this woman intently and liked watching her fail. And I found it really, really, really difficult to watch. But would you have ever written that, though? People would have gone, that is ludicrous. That could never happen.
Absolutely.
They've lost it now.
Satire,
is there, is there jumped, a difference? Jumped the shark. Is Theresa May's also jumped the shark. She has.
Is there not an element also in there about, do you treat male and female public figures slightly differently? And are there, even if they're unspoken rules, because I know what you mean. I think
I did have to call out sometimes the scripts for Theresa May. I would sort of say, well, that's actually not her. That's misogyny. I mean, because she was, you know, there was a lot of misogyny. The way she was treated in Europe, you know, you could see them all kind of going like that. And then it was so galling to see Boris Johnson there and we're all sort of going, you know, good on you, mate. And
we've got a chat.
What suddenly happened?
Is there something, an example in the script that you felt, no, we're not going to do that?
Sometimes,
Can you give an example?
Yes, I have to be the, you know, the misogyny police.
Well, I mean, I'll give an example from Newswatch, which is not deliberately satire. But, you know, we get viewers' comments in, and it's really interesting. We get certain male viewers saying, those two female presenters, they were gossiping like fishwives. The phrase, like fishwives. Yeah. And I've had this conversation with our producer to say, we're not putting phrases like that on air.
No.
You know. It's really interesting.
Because it's, you know, things like that, they seep in, don't they? And you know, you do have to sort of, you have to be very alert to
them. No one's ever described Boris Johnson as being feisty.
No.
Or a fishwife.
People say that about me all
or bubbly.
Or bubbly.
Vivacious.
Yes.
Vivacious Boris Johnson. Do you know what I like about Boris Johnson? He's sassy.
Yeah.
So much sass.
He really gives them what for, Boris Johnson.
Can I ask a bit about the environment in which satire is potentially taking place? You said sometimes people do it on social media without necessarily realising. There is this sense that the wrong thing or a supposed joke taken the wrong way can very quickly escalate. Mm. And I wonder what all your views are about that sort of cultural sense of offence taking seems to have quick consequences.
There's two things. I mean, one is, I think, you know, over the decades, certain attitudes have changed. So there are certain jokes that, you know, made 30 years ago that you wouldn't dream of making now. But I think that's separate from being so afraid of offending anyone that you sort of self-censor. It's like you said earlier, I ask myself, what is wrong with being offended? You know, if you have a set of beliefs, whether they're religious beliefs or political beliefs or whatever, they should be able to withstand some kind of challenge. And if they can't stand a joke, then I put it to you that those beliefs haven't really been strongly thought through.
Well, I used to get that sometimes from feminists, you know, saying, why are you taking the piss out of all these women? You go, well, because I don't do men. But, you know, why are you taking the piss out of all these women? Well, you know, if women can't take a joke about them and you're going to say, okay, we won't do any jokes about women because, you know, it might offend them and it's not fair. Well, women have got to have the confidence. If you're going to be out in the public eye, you've got to have the confidence to have the piss taken out of you. And that goes for anybody else as well. I think that's right.
And I said, you know, always be suspicious of the person who can't take a joke because they're usually the ones that end up causing the most destruction, really. I mean, most dictators do not like comedians. They don't like jokes because jokes are, you can't control laughter. Laughter is spontaneous. They don't like that. They don't like anything that's spontaneous.
Jess, where are you on the whole issue about offence and social
media? Yeah, I think that if you... I don't think that you shouldn't take the piss out of women. I don't think that you shouldn't take the piss out of people for their political views. Or I think that we're in a sort of worrying time where the offence taken is largely... It's partially what you've said about maybe you haven't thought through your opinion, but the offence taken is a cover for something else, actually. It's like a proxy war. Where somebody will hate you for some other thing, misdemeanor that you have committed, and then if you make a gag at somebody's expense, they will assume bad faith. There is so much bad faith in the world that you cannot... It feels, I'm not saying, like, I'm not Alf Garnett. I don't want to go around being like a wanker all the time and get away with it. I am saying that, personally for me, people taking the piss out of me, I actually find it quite flattering. I don't mind being sent up. I think it's my dad, when I was on Dead Ringers, my dad rang me immediately. he listens to it religiously. But when people write awful things about me, even in the newspapers, when it's not even funny, honestly, I think that if we can't take it as public figures...
You shouldn't be out there.
And it is different if you are famous for something else, actually.
Well, slightly different issue, just to take it on a bit, which is there is this accusation made sometimes about not punching down. Yeah. So the culture of sort of French satire, and, you know, Charlie Hebdo magazine was pretty harsh, and it's you know, quite extreme. But there was an accusation made that, you know, satirising Muslims, who were quite a demonised group anyway, never in any way trying to excuse a terrorist, you know, murderous attack. There was something about that magazine and its misogyny and its racism, which perhaps wasn't fair. And I don't know what your views
are.
But
I mean, yes, but the solution isn't to go in and shoot them.
Yeah, should have been an element of self-censorship, you know, separate to whether an attack ever took place.
Of course, I mean, I'm not arguing that. I mean, I actually went online and looked at the cartoons to see what the... And they weren't very good, you know, apart from anything else. And I do think also another reason to kill them. But if you are taking on a sensitive subject, I think there is a responsibility to at least do it well, you know, to think through what the point is you're trying to make, and is this the best way of making it? Does that joke work? Is it very clear what the target is? Could someone misunderstand it, or, you know, have you? I think you have to put extra work into it if you are going to look at a subject that's a bit more sensitive. I mean, I spent a couple of years ago, I made this film, The Death of Stalin, and it was a comedy, but it was about.
It was pretty dark.
It was dark. Now, and what we did was we decided that we would show the gulags and the shootings and so on. We would show them and without any kind of commentary on them. And all the comedy would be coming from inside the Kremlin. But the decisions these people in the Kremlin make, we would see enacted out for real. And that was the approach. But researching that, people who grew up under Stalin at the time would say, look, we had jokes about Stalin. And you could be shot if you told these jokes.
Yeah, tell me a bit about that.
But it was like they were saying, look, they could take my family away, they could take my job away, they could lock me up, but if I could still make a joke about you, you haven't taken my spirit away. You know, that was the last weapon, really.
I think we are lucky
that we live at the moment in a society where if we make a joke about someone, we are not going to be shot, you know. But
I have to say, I don't always feel like that.
Right.
Personally, yes. I don't feel that sometimes when not so much joking, although I like a joke, I do, you know, sometimes I find myself going, oh, I shouldn't say this because I might get killed. And that is a genuine reality, I think, that people in certainly political public life face. I'm not going to say too much more about it because my son is on the front row.
But I was actually wondering, and this is slightly sort of off the point of satire, but I was slightly wondering in the point of, you know, the way women are portrayed satirically, but also the what you talk about being a female public figure, female politician. Do they get more of all that? All the threats and
much more than men. And actually, I think that there is an element of it that is about comedy as well, is that the abuse that can be crafted towards men is much, much easier to make funny and light. And so it's much less like a knife. Whereas with women, it immediately goes to sexual violence. It immediately goes to the physicality of the way you look. It immediately goes to sex, both your sex and sex with you. That isn't funny. Now, if somebody genuinely... I often put this back to trolls on the internet and say, just be a bit more original. Because I like a laugh. That if somebody has genuinely crafted an amazing cuss on the internet at me, I take my hat off to that. But it is, the vast majority of it is, hasn't been thought through. It is, oh, I wouldn't even rape this bitch. And that, actually, I think that if there was an element of humour and thought into it, and it's much easier to do that with Boris Johnson, it's much easier to do that with Chris Grayling, it's much easier. We don't, our head doesn't immediately go to violence, because we don't use violence in society actually to control men in the way that we use it to control women.
Can I just point out these kinds of comments? I mean, the president of Brazil has basically joked about that way about women. I was watching the film Bombshell recently where, you know, Trump made that comment about, was it Megyn Kelly, the Fox presenter, about bleeding from everywhere.
Oh, yes, it was
really interesting the way that he uses the language of jokes.
Yes.
To actually say, oh, I was just joking about Ukraine.
Yes, and they'll say that afterwards. Oh, he was just joking. Yes, but, it was a terribly written, poorly performed, ill-thought-through joke. Which is another reason why he should be the leader.
But where does that leave satire? That we are in that world where presidents can joke.
That is the thing. They've become their own entertainers. They are. Donald Trump sees himself as essentially a salesperson, an entertainer. He's all about getting an immediate reaction. He's all about numbers, you know, how many people turned up at my inauguration, the ratings for my State of the Union. It's all about that. So I sort of leave that kind of self-basting satire that he does about himself to himself, which is why I think the responsibility then falls on other people to do a bit more work and a bit more digging around in terms of the jokes, analysing what he's doing.
You know? Jan?
Well, I was just thinking as you were saying that, I mean, I'm almost sort of at a point with Donald Trump where I think he must be unwell.
Oh, clearly, yes.
I mean, because if you see footage of him sort of, you know, from earlier times, he's quite articulate. You might not like what he's saying, but he's quite articulate, and he's talking at a sort of, you know, a sort of steady pace. Whereas now, you know, yeah, there's nothing, you know. And he, it's like, what are you on? And, well, actually, some comedian's done a whole thing about actually what he is on. But anyway, I better not say any more about that. But
he starts five sentences at once. So he'll say, you know, the other day, and by the way, Nancy Pelosi, and I've got to say, the chairs in that place were beautiful.
Beautiful chairs. I know
Melania,
them well. Yeah.
Anyway, Iraq, you know, and he's like, his verbal desktop has all these kind of apps all over the place, and that, I think that worries me.
It is very worrying, but I mean, we can't sort of, I think you're right. I think the guys that the sort of the satirists that are going more for the sort of the serious side of things, the taking it apart, the saying this is what he says, but this is what actually this is what actually happens. So it's all sort of, it's kind of data based satire kind of thing, and you know, good on them. But I mean, I do think it's important to be able to laugh about it. I do think the release is important as a society. You know, I think it's important to be able to have a laugh about things. And actually, one of the things that does worry me about satire in this country, certainly, is that actually not that many people have that release, because, you know, it's fairly niche still. You know, it's Radio 4, or it's, you know, it's BBC 2, or it's, you know, it's not reaching a wide audience. You know, it's not, you know, that, I mean, I think that sometimes the kids do find it, because I actually found, like, with the Theresa May thing, it went completely viral because it went on a Young Labour site or something, and then a Young something. It was picked up by young people. And when I went to Edinburgh and said to my woman that was giving out the flyers, just go up to, you know, middle-aged people, because, you know, there's no point going to any of the young people that you meet in the street, you know, that they won't know who I am. And she goes, oh, no, I've been talking about it to lots of my friends, and, you know, they've seen the thing on YouTube. And I was thinking, oh, well, wow, that's interesting. Because I think it is a problem that you know, that it does need to go to a wider audience, because you need, you know, it would be great if, but it is, and it is perpetrated very often by white middle class people. I mean, you know, private, you know, right from TW3 to Private Eye now to, you know, a good deal of the people writing programmes like Dead Ring as a News Jack.
That kids, I can only speak for my own children, they watch a huge amount of American satire online. And my son Danny, who is 11, who is not here, he watched this morning The Death of Stalin. He loves it. His favourite joke in it is the no problem joke. Where he says, no problem. He loves it. He says it to me all the time. But he also once told me that I should get ready because he was like, are you not ready? Are you not oven ready? So the amount of propaganda that my children see online is terrifying. But they watch a huge amount of, what's the chap who's from Birmingham originally?
Jasper Carrot?
No. There's an American bloke and he's from Birmingham originally. What's his name? He was on...
John Oliver. Oh, yeah, he's great.
Absolutely shedless.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, but then he's archetypally what I was talking about. He has a huge team of researchers, and he puts and he's committed. You know, he's absolutely passionate about, you know, getting to the underneath the skin of each topic.
Fantastic. Right, we're going to take some questions. Yes, go ahead.
Good evening. First question.
Hello.
With the demise of print media, do you think that the nature of satire has changed? So, for instance, having to be in Twitter in shorter formats, or it being much easier to do things in AV formats. Do you think the nature of satire has changed?
I really like you talking about the decline of print journalism, and I think it then emerges through other outlets. And you were talking about the younger generation. A lot of their conversation and their political conversation, or their comedy conversations, happening online and via social media. During the election, when the Conservative Party changed its name for a day to Fact Check UK, which I have to say is not a million miles away from the Ministry of Truth.
Yes.
What was really funny was instantly people like Charlie Brooker and various others, including myself, we changed our names to Fact Check UK as well, because you could just, they didn't realise, you could just copy their photos that they'd put up. And so suddenly it was like, I am Spartacus. Suddenly it was like 100,000 Fact Checked UK, you know. And then, so you could then put anything you like underneath it, because it was endorsed by Fact Check UK. So,
but that has, I mean, it's interesting because it has an impact as well.
Yes.
Of course, it prompted the government to change back.
And I think that's where it's in these unexpected, you know, if good satire is to be disruptive, then it will come from these unexpected, much more spontaneous, instant responses, but creative responses.
Right, there's one up.
We've talked a bit about the John Oliver show, and it's great and clearly very well researched. But why do you think we don't have something similar in the UK? Is it that no one's pitching it? Is it that no one's commissioning it? Why isn't it here?
I think timidity, is and also...
And actually cost sometimes
cost,
because,
yes,
you know,
those are expensive shows.
Good script writers, don't come cheap. So they'd rather have, you know, talking heads, which, you know, you can. Yeah, it's an expensive thing to do.
And
the writer's room is a very American phenomenon.
It's a very American thing. But John Oliver's show is on HBO on a Sunday night, and it gets about 0.9% of that nightly viewing. But that in America is big enough, plus the repeats and the online and the life online and the consolidated figures over the, you know, that's more than enough to, in terms of subscriptions and, you know, so it pays for it. But we don't have that bigger country. We don't have that enormous population.
Does the MASH report come closer?
I think that's possibly
what, sorry, the MASH report.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the MASH report is the MASH report is good.
I think that the cost thing is the issue, because the MASH report is so up to the minute, and I know because I was with some of them once when something had changed in Parliament, and they were like, stop changing shit.
I know.
Trying to write this stuff down. And it was very, over the Brexit negotiations, it was so incredibly impossible, because it just, who knew what was going to happen from one minute to the next. It takes huge numbers of people writing literally seconds, because it has to be kept literally up to date. It will potentially be much easier in an era where Boris Johnson has a majority of 80 and Parliament will be in, you know, the sort of drama of having
votes where the chair has to decide which way the vote's going to go is gone, it will potentially become much easier. But
of course, it will be shutting down the BBC, so...
Yeah. Also, the public sector broadcasting thing is part of the reason why as well, because both on Channel 4 and BBC, where this would exist, unless, you know, Channel 5 or Dave is going to invest heavily in it.
But in terms of keeping up to the minute, what topical programmes generally do is they have a sort of bank of sketches that aren't topical, where, you know, our reporter goes and sees what, you know, young single mothers are doing or something, you know, and so they can sort of, like, you know, there's these like building blocks in the programme that sort of, and then you've got the news desk items that are sort of absolutely right up to the minute, that make the whole programme feel topical. So, have you had my back all night? I'm so sorry.
I suppose, have I got news for you as well?
Yes.
But that's just because it's just a commentary on what has happened throughout the week.
Easier. I've got one down the front. I've got number three. Have you got someone near you?
With the advent of social media and the sharing of memes and all those sorts of things, do you think that the satire sort of distribution is going to go back to the kind of pamphleteering days and those sorts of things rather than the sort of produced, like, televisual...
I like those things that just creep out, you know, it's the equivalent of saying, "Oh, have you seen this?" You know, just sending a link.
Because people don't actually have to make a whole program anymore. Like Michael Spicer, is it Michael Spicer? I got the name right. You know, doing the things where he's in the room next door.
Yes.
So he's like trying to. He puts out these films called The Room Next Door, where he's like being the voice in the ear of the politician, and he's done them with recently Priti Patel, I think, going, you know, don't say counter-terrorism, and she goes, "Well, we have to stop counter-terrorism. We really do," and you know, doing that thing of agreeing with herself all the time.
How does she not fall over more often?
I don't know.
To say it once is a misspeak. To say it 19 times or whatever.
I mean, and he just goes, "No, don't say it again. No, don't say it again." And she goes, "So what it is with counterterrorism?" And he goes,
"Have you done much Priti Patel?"
Pardon?
Have you done much Priti Patel?
I have done Priti Patel, because Priti Patel is doing that thing with time where she is saying all the words that are ending in "in" without the "g" on the end, because she is trying to be more relatable. She really is. And she is, she is agreeing with herself all the time. And she says, "What are you going to do?" Which is right and correct. You know, she sort of like tells you that it's right. After, you know, I mean, she's absolutely extraordinary.
Always that smile as well, on her face.
But there was that great moment, wasn't it, when Andrew Marr accused her of smirking?
Yes.
And she wasn't smirking.
No, That is just her face. I, when you say "I do Priti Patel," because in the voting lobbies in the House of Commons, it's done by we have the same, surname beginning letter, so if she's P, I'm P, and so often when I'm voting in the lobby in the opposite side, I pretend to be Priti Patel to try and get her to vote in the Labour lobby. So I say my name as I go through, I say Priti Patel, and they have never once marked her down as voting in the wrong lobby yet, but one day I picked Priti Patel because I knew that no one could ever mistake me for Priti Patel. So
you're saying politics is not the childish set of games that is so often portrayed in the media.
Right, number six. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. What young satirists do you rate, if any? And what advice would you give to them?
My advice is just always keep going. You know, there is really no... You know, we grew up in a kind of environment where you had to go into London and sit in a writing room and write some stuff and hope it might get used. Now... You can make your own stuff. That's the beauty of how the technology and social media work. You can make stuff, and I think you just get better the more you make. But you don't have to wait now to be asked to make it. And you know, the best new satirists are the ones that haven't appeared yet. You know, I like the when they just pop up and you're genuinely surprised by. I remember when Peter Serafinovich, the first 2 years of Trump's administration, Peter Serafinovich, who's an impressionist as well as an amazing actor, did this thing called Sassy Trump, which was just taking speeches by Donald Trump, unedited, but replacing them with a kind of sort of like a Liberace voice, because his hand gestures are so slightly, yeah, you know, like that. And it's such a wonderful, you know, and it just so transformed. But it then made you listen actually to what he was saying. And it, and you just thought, this is terrible. This is horrific, you know. And it's, no one could have sat down in a meeting and said, why don't we do this? It's just one of those things someone mucking around came up with, and it just worked beautifully.
Jane Godley does those amazing voiceovers.
Yeah. Yes, I love those.
Yeah, they're very funny. I mean, Bill Dare, who produces Dead Ringers, he actually teaches a comedy writing course, and he does bring up new young writers, and there are now actually quite a number of young women writing on Dead Ringers, which, you know, there never used to be. It used to be very much a sort of... I mean, I always call topical comedy the last bastion of male chauvinism. It did seem like there were, you know, it was all... white middle class men, but that is changing, which is good.
Do you think that the Jane Godley example, she has done me a couple of times, and I absolutely love having a really like broad Scottish accent in it. I've genuinely found it charming, but that example of her, because she is quite a big supporter of the Scottish Nationalist Party. And I wonder if, and obviously you've said that you're a member of the Labour Party and comedy is largely the bastion of the left, usually. Well, it's the bastion of against the establishment, I suppose, which the left holds. I wonder if, in the Jane Godley example, who I think is really, really funny, if you're so obviously going to only send up your opponents, not those on your own side, is that satire anymore? Is it?
Well,
it's polemic, I suppose, isn't it? Because it has an agenda. I mean, I am a member of the Labour Party, but I do send up people in the Labour Party.
I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I send up members of the Labour Party,
including yourself.
But I'm not a member of any party, but I the only time I get vitriol is when I make a joke on Twitter about Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
And it does worry me that, going back to what we were saying earlier about, if we're just saying we can joke about the others but not about ourselves, we cannot take a joke, then, you know, the great thing about comedy is that it sort of unites us, you know. If you can make everyone laugh, then there's some kind of connection going on. But if you're starting to say, no, you can laugh, but I don't want any of you laughing... then,
that's what I mean about the bad faith. So if I make a joke about like one of my mates, so who would be considered to be from my wing of the Labour Party, and I take the piss out of them online, which I do all the time, like in friendly humour. Whereas if you were to do that to, so it's considered in such bad faith that you're a baddie, and that if you take the piss out of Jeremy Corbyn, that's because you hate the NHS.
Oh,
I mean, literally, like...
So you'd rather children died.
Yeah.
And this was me having a go at anti-Semitism. So, I'd much prefer anti-Semitism than children die. Of course. We're all agreed on that. We're all, you know, come on. There's no two questions about this. Anytime. Anti-Semitism first, obviously. Perfect choice, yeah. What? You know...
Right.
Madness.
Okay, well, I think this one down the very front.
How much of the satire that you produce is to make change or to be an activist? And if it is, do you change some of it to make more change?
I personally don't do satire to bring about change, because I don't think satire is ever going to bring down the government. But like I said earlier, I think it can maybe change people's minds and make people see things a bit differently. I mean, on Spitting Image, you know, there was that famous incident of when David Owen and David Steele in the Liberal Democrat Alliance thing, it so happened that they didn't have a proper size David Steele puppet, so they got the prototype David Steele puppet and put it in the pocket of the David Owen, and it sort of worked so well as a little David Steele puppet, and then David Owen being very sort of, you know, the big smoothie, and in fact David Steele was, you know, had more MPs and was a more powerful man, but he always reckoned that his career was ruined by the fact that he was portrayed as a tiny little thing on Spitting Image, which, you know, people sort of say, actually, you know, he wasn't. But I mean, that was one of the things where it did sort of... they had satire in, you know, the Weimar Republic, and it didn't, despite Charlie Chaplin and everything, you know, didn't stop Hitler. So I don't think satire is... I think to say well, satire can't change anything. Look at how ridiculous everything is. So there's no point. I think that, you know, there's lots of point in it without it needing to change, needing to change the government. I mean, however much you might hope for that, I don't think satire is going to do it. But yeah, maybe it'll make people see things a different way and have a laugh.
Do you want to move? Jess, did you want to?
I would just say that I agree with that about satire, but I use comedy to try and bring down the government all the time. because actually the quickest way to get a room of people to trust you, whether they agree with your politics or not, is to make them laugh.
Mm. Yeah, but and I think it works in your situation.
It works in my situation.
I think it works as a perpetrator, but not a commentator.
The reality of it is, though, is that you will always be considered not to be serious, even though the language largely of politics in ordinary people's homes, certainly in working class people's homes, is humour. And we have a different view of it in Westminster. And so that you can absolutely use humour to bring down people like Boris Johnson. And what worries me, actually, about our current approach as the Labour Party is that we have lost any sense of puncturing with humour and only ever try and just be holier than thou. And I think that the public can't see it, whether they can hear a joke.
Mm. Final thoughts from each of you.
Not just fake media, but the fact that there is, you know, we all have our own media now, so you do get, like, Boris Johnson telling ministers not to go on the Today programme. He's no longer going to take as many interviews as normal, as prime ministers normally would, because they've got their own channel now. They've got the Boris Johnson Facebook page, and for him, he's using that as justification for how he's speaking directly to the people without the annoying interference of a respected journalist asking him a succession of well-researched questions. And that is another worrying development as well.
Yeah. What shampoo do you wear? Do you use was the question you select your own question. So he selected, what shampoo do you use? And he didn't even know the answer. I mean, pick one you know the answer to. He said, it's in a blue bottle or something. It's just like, you know what? He should have said Tresemme. That would have been really funny.
Jan, I'm going to give the final word to you. Do you want to?
Well, I've got completely distracted, actually, by what? Oh, I know what I was going to say. Yes, I mean, I think I do think now we are at a point where it is as important to be satirising the way that news is disseminated, as opposed to just the news itself, because there's so much fake news, there's so much people saying things that just blatantly aren't, or then saying one thing and the next week saying another, or, you know, like Amanda says, having this direct access to people. So I think we really, you know, if we really have to keep a close eye on the way on the way things are being presented to us, and not just the things themselves.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all the speakers, thank you, the audience, Intelligence Squared as well. I wonder what kind of conversation we'll be having in 5 years from now about the age we're in and what's happening.
How long are you in for?
I mean, I'm going away forever.
Thank you all very much. Good night.
Thank you.